So do you, are you in fact a Quaker, or were you a Quaker then?
Yes, I was a pacifist, you see.
Yes.
I hadn't actually joined Quakerism. Mm. I was a pacifist. Mm. And the result was I hated war. From my very roots upwards, from boyhood, because I saw that that was the great thing which would subjugate humanity, always. Whatever advances we make, war will destroy them, absolutely. And there's got to be an absolute reorientation of men's minds with regard to it. When I see a woman, for instance, giving her kid a toy pistol, running around shooting people laugh. It isn't a matter of laughing for me. It's planting something in that kid's mind.
Yeah, I quite see.
And they say, oh, this is the dear old killjoy. Never in it.
Do you mean it?
And I think it was led, as far as I remember, by a girl in armour on a horse.
Charlie Marsh.
Yes, yes.
Well, it always abuses me because I was a stripling. I was very thin. None of the flesh since, but I was very wiry, very tough, but I was thin. This time a great banner, I had the thing on me, stuck in my stomach, you know. The little Londoner slid up to me and said, "Say, mate, carry your banner for a dollar." I said, "Right." And so, en route, we changed places, you see, and he carried my for and then they had, of course, this tremendous gathering in Hyde Park. But the point about it all is that not one newspaper reported that procession the next day. Mm. You see, not one.
They were marvellous processions, weren't they? They dressed up and had marvellous banners, didn't they?
Oh, yes. They did everything to show that they could equal men, you see, and so on. And, but upon the other hand, of course, what was rising all the time was the bitterness that was increasing against the growth of this movement. Mm. See, the government, they dare not hold a meeting that a woman in is forcibly feeding.
Mm.
See, women got a hunger struck, and they couldn't hold them. They got to such a point that they were so tremendously ill that they had to let them out, have a dead woman on their hands, you see, and then the public outcry. Well, I think it's Winston Churchill who was eventually responsible for a great number of days. They let her out under the cat and mouse. And directly her friends nurse her back to something like mobility and decent state. And in they come, seize her, put her back again. Repetition. Well, you know, if you're a man of sensitivity at all, that kind of thing not only gives you contempt, but I'm a Quaker, I'm a pacifist, but my God, I could smite any of them.
And you felt like that at the time?
Of course I did, you see. Mm. That was how I was feeling. And there was a great, they raided the House of Commons, you see. It commenced to get more and more, they said, "We've stuck it all along, you see. We're not going to have any war." So, on a certain night, I was in London at the time, they went out in batches from houses where they'd place themselves during the day, and they demanded to be to enter the house. peace, of course, were all brought there in great battalions. He brought them from all over. He brought them up from the East End to the roughest of all. And they insulted and treated these women abominably. Knocked them about and so on. I mean, you can see photographs of this as Paris, but in a great garland of a great place, a great cray.
Great, yes.
She always carried a dog whip, which had been given to her by her fiancé. I know why she carried that dog whip. I mean, I was never told, but I know from my experience, when they got her outside, their hands would not be far off in her clothing.
Mm.
That would be my conclusion. And she told her fiancé, and he said, you take this dog whip.
Mm.
Well, that was the kind of feeling that was now growing, you see.
Mm.
And the result was that by the time war was declared, it got to the point that now they were saying, we've suffered it all along, says the bankers. We've taken every humiliation, we've taken violence, but now we're going to give violence for and so they commenced burning. They all selected empty houses.
Mm-hmm.
They schemed it most carefully. But it was a most terribly dangerous game. The thing I didn't agree with in any way was they poured all kinds of muck into postal boxes, you see.
Yes.
And they, altogether, the mood had changed. From suffering, they took all the suffering on themselves. Now, they were not going to take any more.
Mm.
They were going to get as, they were going to give as good as they got, as far as they could. Well, my wife was summoned by letter to go to London and for a special meeting. And this special meeting was to instruct the organizers of the and people who were semi-organized. They wanted her to be an organizer, but she wouldn't. And these people were to instruct young people who would come down to London, and they wouldn't know what they were there for, especially in violence. And I was living in Letchworth, Garden City, at the time. This was in its earliest days.
A lot of progressive people lived there, didn't they, at that time?
Mm. And, everybody was a crank, of course. and the, from Letchworth, it was easy, half a crown a day, excursion ticket, you see. She went down, she came back late, very serious. And she found that what the meeting was about was this. They were to instruct young people who were fully enthusiastic for the suffrage movement who would come along, not knowing the purpose which they were sent for, instruct them in violence, stone throwing.
Arson.
Anything.
Mm.
She said to me, I cannot do this. She said, what one does on one's own is one's own, but to take young girls and young women, she said, struck me this way. And I gave it to, I expect you've met her, the girl who wrote the book, the latest book on the suffrage.
Antonia Raeburn, you mean? Yes.
I gave it to her. They had given my wife a piece of black linen, tape cut, which went round the waist. There was a broad pocket in this way with a slit in the side. And you wouldn't know anything about it, but in those days, women wore dresses with what they called placket holes. And it was a slit at the side of the dress here through which you could stiff your hand. and they could slip their hands through that and here, between their legs at Barnaby in front of them, would be stones, you see, in this bag, sort of flat back, and a linen bag, which would be slit side, easy access. You'd slip your hand in there, grab your stone, and you'd have it.
Mm.
So, we had a long talk.
Your wife was given one of these.
Oh, yes.
I see, yes.
I had it, kept it for years, and I gave it just recently to Antonio Rebo. Now, she said she was going to hold an exhibition of suffragette relics somewhere.
Very interesting, yes.
I don't know what to give it.
Mm.
Anyhow, but we decided we could not indulge in this leading in violence. So
you and your wife, that is.
Mm.
That's right. That didn't mean we altered our point of view about the suffrage movement.
Yeah.
That was it. Mm. And then the war came, of course it all went flat. Pankhurst, to our disgust, went on the recruiting platform.
Mm.
She absolutely, Sylvia, I think it was, who was a very fine character. She was in the Doug's house with her mother and wanted to have anything to do with military. And for 6.5 years, I gave my services and life to Orpington 3.
What did that involve you?
2.5 years in refugee camps. Then I took over, at their request, the London, what they called warehouse, which was the center of equipment of all supplies. And in the end, I had 20 men employed there by me. They started when I started, there were 3. You see, whilst the war was on, there was no possibility of sending stuff abroad for these purposes. It's all military, you see.
Mm.
And the government backed the scheme that we had going. It was called a pound-for-pound scheme. Every pound's worth of refugee material, they gave another. So in a reference they gave me at the end, they said that he has had the sole handling of £200,000 during this, which meant £200,000 worth of material. And been a tremendously devoted worker. I ran the place for that meant sending stuff abroad to all the various sectors. So try to undo some of the evil that war and violence does.
Mm.
And that will occur every time I look at today's newspaper.
Mm. It's terrible.
I don't want to read the newspapers these days.
Mm.
I mean, if you've seen, I remember when the city of Lille was evacuated by the Germans. They used to prophesy great things for me. I remember the head of the academy met me after, I told you I didn't finish it about Sir Stephen Gatty.
Oh, yes, yes.
You see, he came along.
Mm.
Just when this was all going on, not long after the Colston Hall episode that I told you, he said, "I've heard of you." He said, "And I've always had in Gibraltar," he said, "a studio for metal." He said, "Now I'm married." He married a lady, a Miss Morrison. She was a family of wealthy, I think, Jews. They bought up army clothing, the whole, portion, as I suppose, I don't know how you put it, the regiment's clothing, that kind of thing. Anyhow, he was married to this lady, They had a house in Grosvenor Gardens, another lovely house in the Cotswolds. He asked me if I'd go and see him with some in Grosvenor Gardens. He said, I have a studio in Ebrus Street. He'd been recently married. And so he said, I want someone to work with me in Ebrus Street to take charge of the studio. So he said, if we agree that you're suitable, you can. Well, I was going to the Royal College of Art the next year. There's no doubt I was at that point a year or two young to go. But the man I was training with, the Price, he said, you take the exam this year. He said, you wouldn't pass. He said, but he said, it would be examination practice for you. I was 7th in 200, I think, of 18. He said, you'll be all right. There were 4 places. He said, you'll be all right next year. Well, then this Getty job came along. My people were poor. And I couldn't afford to have them keep me 4 years at the Royal College of Art, plus my initial training in the provinces, you see. Especially when the salaries were such training.
Yeah.
Think of that.
It's incredible, isn't it? Now, no, it's amazing.
Yes. If these present students knew anything about it,
parents, socialists, or not, were you the first in the family to be a socialist?
Well, one of my to be a socialist, did you say, or
to be a socialist? Yeah, to be a socialist.
My father was a socialist. All my family were associated. They were either seamen on the one side, or they were villagers upon the other.
In Bristol or?
Oh, the west of England. My grandfather, for instance, he sailed around the world before he was 20. And he rescued 3 people from that Bristol Harbour float. And the first time, he jumped, as he used to call it, jumped for the man. He took off his boots. They stole his boots. The next time, when they came running, his name was Charles. Mr. Charles, there's a man in the float. He's drowning. Come. He commenced taking his boots off. They said, do jump for him. He'll be dead. He said, it's all right. He's a fat man. He'll float. He put his boots around his neck. But 2 of them were rescued with the old man with the boots tied around his neck. It's the signs of the time.
But how did your father come to be a socialist? I mean, it was unusual in those days to be a socialist.
Yeah, so it was unusual. Well, I can't tell you, it's temperamental. You see. And he was an artist.
Was he?
In temperament. And he was a splendid builder. He was not an architect. But you give him the drawings, and he'd build you. I remember him taking me to Painswick outside Bath to a quarry where he was selecting stone in the quarry itself, you see, for a big building he was putting up. And on another occasion, I was about 14 at the time, he was going to do a certain building. And the architect brought along the plans. He wanted duplication of the plans. So he brought them home, and over the weekend, I got going, and I traced these plans perfectly. So when he was working from them next week, the architect said to him, look here, what's the meaning of this? These are not my plans. He said, no, they're not. Well, he said, who did them? He said, my boy. what age is he? Maybe about 13, 14. So tell him he can have a job with me any time he likes.
Really? So you had that ability very early on?
Yes, very early. I was brought up in that atmosphere as we craftsmanship all the way through.
Mm. But you say he wasn't a very... they were quite poor, your family. I mean, he didn't make a lot of money then with...
Oh, he didn't make a lot of money. None of them did.
No.
The highest paid of the finest craftsmen, those masons were magnificent craftsmen. It wasn't just a question of picking up bricks and a lump and mortar and so on. Each stone was carved.
Mm.
Each stone was given a mold that you worked to. He would take those plans and translate them into the building. That was his job.
Mm.
He was one of the finest men at that time in the west of England.
Was he really?
Oh, yes.
And his father was... His father was a naval man.
No, his father was also in the building trade.
Oh, was he?
Mm. They say he put the pinnacles on Gloucester Cathedral.
Did he really?
But on my mother's side, they were all seamen.
Were they? I see.
They said, don't ever go to sea. It's the hardest life you can go.
What was your mother's name?
Charles.
Her name was Charles. Her surname was Charles, was it? Yes, I see. Yes.
Unusual, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, and your name is Charles. Your Christian name is Charles. Were they Quakers?
No. Never heard of it.
Mm.
Oh, no.
Your father wasn't either.
My father wasn't a Quaker either.
Were they nonconformists of any sort?
Mm. No, my mother was a religious woman, but she very rarely went to church.
But they were some nominal Anglicans, really, were they?
Church of England.
Mm. Mm.
But I was interested in the church. I was interested in the old one. 14, I'd go anywhere to hear an organ recital. My mother said to me on one occasion, you're a funny kid. She said, I've never heard of a boy. She said, going to organ recitals. She said, what attracts you to the organ? I said, what is it? I can't understand it. Well, I said, it's like an elephant dancing.
Very good description.
Oh, very bad. I went to the Merchant Ventures Technical College in Bristol, which was the best educational establishment of its type. It originated, of course, by the old Merchant Ventures of Bristol. You see.
Mm.
And they had a very scientific head by the name of Bertimer. And I believe they were the first people, this was after my time, to establish a motor engineering workshop.
You mean you decided to leave?
I decided to leave.
When there was only an hour
a week.
I had
a scholarship going, and I left 3 months before the year was out.
Mm.
And when the head got to know, sorry, this was on the cards, he called me up from the class in which I was in, and he said, I hear you're talking about leaving. Why? I told him. He said, look, you're going to stay here and you're going to take a BSc.
Mm.
The last thing in the world I want.
Mm. So you had brain for it, obviously.
Obviously. So I said, why not? So he said, well, that's what I've got you down for. He said, if there's any question of money, he said, we can provide. I said, no, I'm not doing it. So he said, what do you intend to be? I said, I want to be an artist. You'll never make any money at that. I said, no, I don't want to make money. Well, we had it up in the home. He was like, as old Tennyson says, a fluttering bird, wagging his gown about and browbeating me, you see. He couldn't shift me, and I moved.
What did your parents think about that, Mr. Bryson?
Well, they didn't like it.
You mean they didn't like you going in for art?
Well, yes, that was all right. But they said you should stay. I was doing 3 years, you see. 3-year scholarship there. They said, you should you've done so well during this time. You should stay out your 3 years. My father didn't mind very much. He said, what's the use? He said, the lad's only getting an hour a week, so-called art. All the rest, he says, is this damn science and languages. I said, well, what of use that's going to be to him.
How old were you when you left, actually, then?
Well, I suppose I was between 15 and 16.
And then you went straight to the west of England?
Oh, no, I had to put in nearly a year before I could, I think the earliest you could get in as a day student was 17. So I simply went and took a job in commerce.
Did you? As a clerk or something like that?
Yes, they made me stock clerk in one of the biggest, it was a distillers, the great distillers company. They had a place called the United Yeast.
Oh, yes.
They supplied all the people with yeast, all these bakers. And so they made me stock clerk. And I had two kids to assist me in this. Stock sheets were tremendous. They supplied everything that a baker, a confectioner, and people of that type. They had, for instance, tea. Great floor, two great mounds of tea like mountains. Then they had 24 different labels, all the golden sunrise. All this kind of thing, vividly coloured and priced and so on. And men with shovels, wooden shovels, shoveling this up. Girls, packers, you see, making this up into packets. And when you have tea like that, gradually there sifts through the finer portions of it, what they call panyang sifting. And the more of those siftings you put in, the stronger the tea becomes. Then the price goes up, you see.
Yes.
Same tea.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, when I used to go over the... You don't know Bristol, do you? Every Saturday afternoon into the woods and we had long walks down to the channel. One night when I came back on Saturday, my father said to me, something's been happening at your place. I said, what do you mean? It's in the paper. He said, your foreman there has been arrested. He's been sending out stuff which people thought were empty packing cases, loaded with goods, to receivers. And the police have got him. Well, when I got in on the Monday morning, I said, check tea. Well, I got up there and, they didn't want to do it, the warehouse people. I said, it's got to be done. How much have you got? It's all laid up and so on. It was very short. So they had 20 clerks in the office, and they used to laugh about these stock sheets because they never balance. I said, nobody's ever balanced them. You can't balance them or anybody else. So they said, how is it priced? I said, they're short. Oh, tell them it's all right. I thought, no, I'm going to report it short. I didn't like to because I knew it involved these people. But I thought afterwards what a perilous situation I was in. If I'd said, well, not like these fellows were telling me. And they were quite honest, decent chaps. I'd said it. It's all right. I should have been involved as a
campus. Yes, yes.
They were tried. And you know, that firm pleaded for them, like anything. They said they'd be taken back into their employ. They'd been there a very long time. And that if they would only give them a light sentence, it would never happen again. They'd been in the hands of a rogue. hadn't in the past, you see.
So you stayed on after that, did you?
No, I left pretty quickly.
Did you?
Because I really had not to do with that at all, because the time was rolling by.
Yes, yes.
So they came to me, I gave in my notice. They said, "What? Do you want more money?" I said, "No." They said, "Well, what are you leaving for?" So I said, "Well, I'm not going on with this." And so they said, "Well, what are you going on with?" I said, "I'm going to the academy, I'm going to train." He said, "Well, see, you'll never make any money at that." "Can't," they said. That's a so-and-so idea, isn't it? And I said, "That's what I'm going to do." They said, "Look, we'll raise your salary, what you want. Stop here." That was the next stage. So, but to get back to suffrage,
did you tell Mr. Harrison about the court case? The court case?
No, we haven't got to that yet.
Oh, don't you? No. Don't forget that.
When we, Sir Stephen Gatty got hold of me, you see. And I was with him for 2.5 years. Oh, a most extraordinary opportunity for a metal worker. Mm. His wife, she inherited during, I was with him 2.5 years. First 18 months, she had £100,000 left her. And a little while afterwards, another with another 100,000. Then a wretched 125,000. This all within 18 months, you see.
And
I was supposed to be working with him.
Mm.
And he was using... He was so well known that he was, spy who did those cartoons.
Oh, no, yes, yes.
Well, he was one of those. He was called the crafty lawyer.
Because he had the court case,
And... So I remained with him 2.5 years.
Were we in London while you were doing that?
No. I used to go along every morning to Evesham Street, just by Victoria Street.
Mm.
George Moore and heaps of celebrities lived there, and he had a studio work. Never did a day stroke work in his life, never did a stroke.
Indeed.
And all kinds of society people came in.
Did they?
Lady Balcaris and so on.
Mm.
And this was Old Gatty.
Mm.
He was using it in the products that I made, you see. He'd show them and say, "This is what I and Mr. Price have done." And a certain lady who was there, she said, "I think it's supposed to be Mr. Price, isn't it?" She just whispered to me. That was another parasite.
How do you come to leave Gatty then? Was that because the war broke out, or...?
Gatty decided, it was before the war broke out. Gatty decided he had so much trouble on with investing all this money in. So he was so thronged with financial affairs he couldn't go on. So he said, "No, look," he said, "I'm not discharging you, you discharge yourself." He said, "Let me know when it's convenient for you to make another job." And so, when I felt the time was up, I simply opened to him. I had a place in that truth at the time. I built a little studio there. And I was making things like these brooches and so on. I lived as an independent craftsman. And on Mauritian lines, you see. And in that truth, which was the liveliest community that England has known for many hundreds of years.
Millicent was teaching,
wasn't he?
Hmm?
Millicent was teaching. £80 a year.
Well, why was it so lively? I mean,
Well, you see, it was a new place. It was a new conception. Ebenezer Howard was the man who conceived it. And he was a parliamentary reporter, actually. He managed to get influence behind him. It was to have every individual house built with a garden. They were a community too. They had their local pantomime in which you represented all the leading politicians of the police and so on, all the quirks. For instance, the suffragette was represented in the pantomime, was getting underneath the committee meeting table, you see, and shouting votes for women and so on. Well, it was a very lively community.
Were there a lot of suffragettes in that community?
Not a great many. You may get probably, you may have had, 15 or something like that. But you see, it wasn't a favourite movement. Never was.
No, not even in socialist circles.
Oh, socialists abominated them very often.
Yes.
Because they were stealing their thunder.
Yes.
And furthermore, you'll find the prejudice in a socialist against women can be as strong as in a conservative. The thing that I did was that when I was in Letchworth, they sent me a notice that I was to appear at the assizes as a grand juror. And I never heard of a grand juror. So I made inquiries and I found that it was a property qualification which I did not fulfill. So I didn't want to do any of this business. So I wrote to the sheriff and told him that I was not qualified as a grand juror. That my property qualification was infinitely below that. And he wrote back and said my name had been on the church door for so many months. And under law, I had to appear at the local assizes at Hartford. So I wrote back and told him that I was not going to, that I absolutely objected to women being tried under laws that they had nothing to do with the making of, and that especially as I was not qualified technically, I asked to be excused. He said, you're to appear. No excuse. I wrote back and said, well, you can have my body there, as you will be, because I knew they'd have me for contempt of court, you see. But you will have neither my will or my assistance. So a suffragette was being tried. This was the assizes. I knew this, and she was coming from Letchworth. I carried her luggage up to the court. When they checked us in, she said who she was. Asked me why, but she said, but you're a grand juror. Down here. I said, I've got to be here, but I'm not a grand juror. Of course, they said, but you're carrying this lady's luggage. I said, yes, she's a friend of mine. So, as a matter of fact, I hardly knew her. I got in. They laid their plans carefully. You see, the newspapers had taken this up. I think there was a paper called the Tribune at that time. I don't know whether I'm right. Anyhow, well, one of them prophesied that I could be fined £500. I could be had for contempt of court. Various other things, you see, all kinds of penalties attached to this. So anyhow, I appeared, got into the court. Then they commenced swearing us in, you see. When they came to my name, will you please sit down? I realized what's up. They were not going to swear me in. Therefore, I should have no legal right in the court at all. They'd keep me there for the assizes. And nothing would happen. It'd waste my time. And they frustrate what I was trying to do, which was to make
an issue of it.
So I thought, well, that's the first order of the court. So I didn't sit down. They went on swearing. Back he comes with his book. Will you please? Oh, your name's Price, isn't it? Yeah. Please sit down. I looked at him like a stranger. Well, I was standing there, finished wearing a morning. There were the magistrates ranged all around. Some of them knew me, some of them were from nurture.
Excuse me, darling, I don't feel well enough to stay.
In comes the judge. Everybody stood, of course. I was still standing there. Then there was a flurry of ushers came to me. Will you please sit down? The court is in session. I said, I don't recognize it. You have no right to try women. The divorce thing had nothing to do with making out. So, there it was. Beyond forcing me violently down into a seat, they couldn't do anything. And everybody, of course, silence in the place, everybody looking on me. Then the judge, he nodded to the chief usher. Little finger goes. Up goes the chief usher for a conference with the judge. The judge was pretty cute. They didn't want this to get about. They wanted it suppressed. And Usher came back, absolutely foul temper. You are at liberty to go. So I went.
So you won your battle.
And I sent him the expenses. Loss of professional time. Railway journey, and so on. I received a lawyer's reply that they were not responsible in law for my actions, and so went on. And but the point was, as somebody pointed out afterwards, if this thing was so vital, he could have smashed the jury system in England. Because if every juror who was summoned got up and said, I object to him, tried under these laws that they've had nothing. Yeah. He said it's a most vital affair. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's why I was let off, because they didn't want me, you see, playing hell with the what they were doing.
The whole system, yes.
So that was that.
But looking back on your young days, Mr. Price, will you describe yourself now as an angry young man, really?
As well.
An angry young man?
Well, that phrase had not arisen. We were not so much angry as disgusted.
I mean, were you? Did you tend to be against authority in many areas?
No, not authority as such, but iniquity as such.
Mm.
And this was iniquitous for women to be classed as criminals, as lunatics.
Oh, I very much agree with that, yes. One thing that did interest me very much was there any connection in your mind at the time between the peace movement, or peace and woman suffrage? And were the two causes linked up?
I thought, that, and I argued this many times, that if women got the vote, a man was a very expensive thing to produce. You had him absolutely, for months, a helpless child. The woman was the only person who could bring that life to anything like maturity at all. And if they had the vote, they would never submit to these costly products out of their own bodies being used as cannon. That was what I used to argue. They wouldn't stand for it. Why should we? produce children for you to send to be murdered. I mean, remember, in the war, 1914-18, Passchendaele, 240,000 men in a single battle, flinging them against the German guns like that.
So, looking back on it, you think your argument was wrong, was it?
No, my argument was right.
I mean, the women didn't.
Oh, you mean the project? Oh, the women didn't fulfil it.
No.
They voted as their... It's going on now. Mm. As their husbands, more or less, voted, you see.
Mm.
I thought that having a vote would so mean that there would be a new orientation in the women's minds.
Mm.
But instead of which, it seems to me that what it's done is it's broken down the barriers in the most extraordinary way in the professions. You even now have a woman judge and doctors. The tremendous difficulty these early women had to become a doctor. I got up and I said, look, we've heard that scientists now do something which can destroy all life on the earth. Why is it then that the churches are not on the streets protesting against this iniquity, against this terrible thing? I said, we have a few people here, hear this. But I said, how is it you have this enormity in our midst and you remain pacific about it. You take no action about it. And I said, why aren't the churches, instead of holding another Sunday evening meeting, I said, why aren't they on the streets?
Mm. So what happened?
Bishop turned and said, we're here, aren't we? That was all that happened.
Mm.
The meeting went on, and a woman got up in the end, she said, and she pointed at me, she said, you've never answered that man's question. That's all.
Did you actually join the CND movement?
Yes.
Right?
Yes, oh yes.
Did you?
Mm. You see, these things, people get habituated to them.
Mm.
If you talk about the atomic bomb now.
Yeah.
I mean,
they just live with it.
They've lived with it.
Yeah.
Probably prevented something worse. Something like that, you see.
Yeah.
So it goes on. It's extraordinary how the most vivid emotions can be dulled in that way.
Mm.
So that was just an episode.
Did you actually join the Society of Friends eventually?
Oh, yes, I joined it.
Did you? I mean, before the First War or
no, yes, before the First War.
Did you?
I joined the Society of Friends.
Mm. And you've been a member ever since?
Ever since.
Yes.
Yeah, that is not quite true, because I made a protest over something that I regarded as being iniquitous. I don't want this to be recorded.
No, I'll switch off. You did mention earlier on when you were talking about the later stage of the suffragette movement when it started getting violent.
Yes.
You disagreed.
Yes.
Did you make your disagreement clear to people or did you just quietly opt out?
Oh, I really quietly opt out.
Yes.
You didn't go around shouting down people who had a different point of view to ours with regard to violence. But
you just didn't want to be involved.
He refused to have anything to do.
I understand. Because not many people did. I mean, Christabel Pankhurst had a complete control over the whole thing, didn't she?
Yes.
I mean,
what do you see? She went to Paris.
Yes.
And everybody who had real guts, they felt it was desertion.
Yes.
The camouflage ones, she's could control the movement from this.
Mm.
Well, it's not good enough. She's living there a luxury life, more or less, in Paris.
Mm.
And she's just issuing her orders to people.
Mm.
You see, and these poor devils going through cat and mouse and all the rest of it, you see.
Do you think, why do you think she went to Paris, I mean, was she frightened of imprisonment herself?
Oh, yes, she would have been, they would have taken her, undoubtedly.
Yes.
So they cleared it, she cleared out.
I was really wondering how widespread among the suffragettes this criticism of her was. I mean, your wife shared that view, did she?
Yeah.
That she was opting out, in a way.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, of course, there was such a thing as Pankhurst worship, you see. And it was extraordinary the way in which those women absolutely worshipped the Pankhursts. And Mrs. Pankhurst was a wonderful. I always looked upon her more or less as a female saint. She had all the aura, if you like, of spirituality in herself. But when it developed the violent side, then of course you had to choose whether you were prepared to go forward, and then you got the girl throwing herself beneath the king's racehorse, you see, and so on.
Yes.
It was, but the war came along and swept that.
Did you ever join any other suffrage organization?
No.
Because there were other organizations you could have.
I'm not a joiner.
Mm.
It isn't in my nature. I'm a loner, actually.
Mm.
I realize that now in my old age. But,
We haven't talked about the Quakers in general and their attitude to women's suffrage. It must have presented Quakers with a great dilemma, really, this militant tactic, didn't it? I mean,
they repudiated it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. You weren't the only one, presumably, who took that line about it.
I mean, you see, there was always the risk of a person being burnt to death. Set fire to a house, you suppose it's empty. Well, tramps get into empty houses and things like that.
Yes.
I mean, and if you get a person burned to death in a house, you see what is going to happen. And besides, violence in itself always produces counter-violence. But mind you, as far as the rough and tumble goes of thought, they had every right for replying with any violence. Mm. Only the point is, it wasn't the people who suffered who'd done the job.
Mm.
You see.
No, I agree. I mean, it was the general public. Yes, I agree. Yes, it's very interesting. Could you ever meet Mrs. Pankhurst yourself?
No, not personally.
Mm.
See, I never wanted to. I've never been a person of courted.
No.
The individuals, you know.
No. But you heard her speak, I suppose.
Oh, yes, we heard her speak. She was a very fine speaker, too.
Was she? Well, a lot of people have said that to me. What impressed you about her way of speaking?
Well, her absolute sincerity. And she almost had a spiritual side to her, you felt. Her husband, of course, was one of the early socialists, and she came up from that school.
You admired Emmeline Pettit Lawrence most of all.
Yes.
Why was that?
Well, very difficult to say why, but she had something that you recognize in a very fine spirit, and the way in which they took those two girls at Annie Kenny, the other girl, and cared for them, and they built them up. And as for Christabel, of course, they absolutely built her.
Yes.
Were
they personally kind to you, the Pettit Lawrences, or did you not meet them personally?
Oh, yes, I met them personally.
Did you?
But not on a social basis. Where I met them was over that jewel that I showed.
Yes, what happened when you met them about that?
Well, what happened was, it was her sister who was the leading light in that, who was going to give her this as something to be checked. because it was absolutely against her nature.
Yes.
This prison and hunger striking. So. Mm. And so they asked me if I could go and meet them, and the man comes in. I saw them there. They told me what they wanted. It wasn't a very nice commission, a woman nailed to the cross.
Mm.
And a broad arrow must be in it.
Mm.
And you imagine that from a designer's point of view.
Mm.
So.
Mm.
But however, I undertook it, and that was the result, you see.
And were you there when she was given it?
No, not the family presentation.
Oh, a pity, really.
In right away. But, no, I wasn't socially.
Mm. You just respect them for what they did for the movement, really. Yes.
Yes. I have tremendous respect for them.
Yes,
I
don't think
he came
down
when I really ended, didn't
he? Yes, he.
Came in, he saw the drawings for this. And he just, so delightful, vanished. And they received the thing.
Mm. What happened to your art, your career as an artist?
Well, you see, what happened is this, that after I had done this 6.5 years, because that's what it amounted to, of war victims' relief.
In the First World War?
I came back. And, you see, we were never paid anything during that time. See, we just had uniform supplies. Our expenses, whatever they were paid, traveling expenses and so on. So.
Mm.
But there was no question of payment.
Mm.
It was only in the very last stages that I told you, when I took over the warehouse and found men employed there at 30 shillings a week, that there was any question of remuneration at all.
Mm.
So you can imagine, funds were not very brilliant. I was a young man, started, had a chance to make money in my career. So when I undertook the Birmingham business, I didn't intend to stop there.
What do you mean the Birmingham business?
Well, you see, I don't know whether I've told you. I was in the end, they worked out 35 years at the College of Art in Birmingham.
Oh, I see. You got a job there, did you? After the war?
They advertised, my wife saw the advertisement, produced it. Said, look, there's a job here you could do. I said, what's that? She said, they called it the School of Art, but it was what is now called the College of Art, same thing. Wanted the chief librarian to build. This is not their language, but this is what it amounted to. They had 500 books, and they were very poor, most of them. Build a fine library, and they had no lecturer on the history of art. Now, it may amuse you, but do you know that it's only within the last few years that in art circles, art education, history of art has become an examination subject.
Mm.
They wanted a lecturer capable of lecturing on the history of art. Well, I'd done a certain amount of it already. You see, I had 5 or 6 prepared lectures, you see, which I was able to produce. And with regard to the librarianship, you can learn librarianship, you know, from the library of that kind of thing. It's the brain that's behind it that's important, you see. Anybody can issue books, that kind of thing. So I took this job because I had now, my wife had been looking after things and teaching. And I had now to find a place in society somewhere.
This was after the end of the First War.
As a craftsman, you see, it's the most precarious living. Because you do a job, you're paid so much, the amount of work, if you're very conscientious, you put into it, you're not properly paid. And that vanishes. It isn't something that will go on and on and on. Then you have to get the next. So I took this job just intending to stay in Birmingham 12 months. I said to her, this is not my job. Stay there for 12 months. Absolutely refused to work on Fridays. Lived in Letchworth. Came down on Mondays. Took over at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Finished Thursday evening. But that didn't finish my job. I was going through London to get to Letchworth. And I was bookbagging like a Jew in the Charing Cross Road. And I built them. You could see it in writing by directors that wanted to produce the evidence from the finest art libraries in the kingdom. For an institution of that kind, I left them with about 6,000 to 7,000 books on art.
Did you really? You built the whole thing up?
Yes, and then the lectures. They had to be given 2 years, course of lectures. Eventually, it worked into, after a year or two, from prehistoric to modern. But that, they hadn't slides for it. I had to get those slides, and you couldn't buy them. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the finest slide maker that I knew, because the average slide you'd have made in something puts it in a dish, develops a black-white thing, and it goes up. And I had a magnificent collection, 6,000 to 7,000.
It's really very necessary for that subject.
That subject, you see. Yes. So that that took all my energy. And I did a bit of work. This angel, for instance, you see. I cast that and worked it and so on. A few other things. But that took it.
I understand.
You can't do the two things.
No.
I mean to do a collegiate career and be a craftsman at the same time on a big scale, on the scale that I was used to. So when you say, what became of your art career? My art career went in training other people.
And you stayed in the Birmingham College of Art for, School of Art for?
30 years.
Did you really?
Then they could get nobody to do my lectures. They asked me to go on for another 5 years.
Did they?
And I went on for 5 years, and then suddenly the whole curriculum changed. This history of art, which had never been an examination subject, was suddenly made one of the most important.
Weren't ever in the men's organisations at all?
No. Never joined any organisation.
No.
And as I say, that Colson Hall episode taught me that there was more danger attached to what I was doing individually than one was altogether entitled to take.
One thing I meant to ask you, the first incident you described when they were on the quayside in Bristol, who were the people who were attacking the women then?
Just the ordinary crowd, the ordinary mob.
Boys and young people.
Yes, anybody. They were good game. See. I mean, it was simply, it wasn't on the quayside and so on, but an example of how bitter was the feeling. It was one of the earliest suffragettes, the finest. It was Mary Cawthorne.
Oh, yes, I know about it.
Well, she was a great friend of my wife's.
Was she?
And they were both, they'd both been in Leeds, they'd taught in Leeds, so on. And she put the question, enchantment of women, a certain meeting. And these thugs, so-called stewards, they attacked her in such a way. That the pressmen put her on their press table and fought for her. Now, the pressmen never take any notice, you know, whenever I was going on. But they tore that woman's intestines in such a way that
she was actually speaking at that first meeting.
Yes.
Time. Was she really?
She was the one that held the crowd.
Was she? And she held you as well?
Well, not at that time, of course, but she did hold them. They didn't, as a matter of fact, there was no holding there because they all jumped for it. But she could hold the crowd.
Mm.
She had a stentorian voice that would carry, you see. She could, without effort, great effort, conduct an outdoor meeting, which lots of women, of course, can't do at all.
Of course. Yes, I mean, you mentioned that one of them was talking in a very shrill voice. Yes, yes. But when you say she was a literary person, did she write?
Yes, I'll give you an example. When she was in the hospital, there was a sister. I went to see her. My present wife arranged that somebody should go to see her, not me personally, but every day. So that she was never without a visitor. And I went into this sister and to ask a question. I forget what it was now. She said, "Your name's Prim." I said, "No." I said, "No." She said, do you know anything of a writer called Millicent Price?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Do you know her?" I said, "Yes, I know her quite well. She's my wife." She said, "And did she ever write a book on Sister Dora?" I said, "Yes." When we first came to this neighborhood, Walsall has a square, and it has a statue in it of a nurse, Sister Dora. If there's a saint in Walsall, she was it. And they even put up a statue to her. And we found we'd be commenced to make inquiries about the Sister Dora and the statue. And none of these small people knew anything except, she was a nurse and she did wonderful things she had. So ML started research. She used she went and got the local newspapers of her day and this kind of thing. Eventually she wrote a small book on Sister Dora.
Did she?
It's called Inasmuch As.
Oh, yes, I think I've seen that.
Inasmuch As.
Yes, yes.
You've done one of these, my little ones. You've done it.
Yes,
one.
Yes.
And so she said, "Did she write a book?" I said, "Yes, Sister Dora." I said, "Yes." She said, "Good heavens." She said, "That's my most valued possession." She said, "That's when I graduated," she said, "at the manor, that's the Walsall Hospital." When I graduated, she said, they gave me this. I value it more than anything I've got.
Well, that's it.
And very, very kind to her. There was terminal cancer.
I see.
And it was terribly difficult because you dare not let her know what it was. And all her friends were saying, "Oh, we'll be out in a month or two, we should be able to come and take you out." So and so, and they knew perfectly well that it was absolutely possible. That was the one thing in the way of books that she did. She did an anthology of old age, which she offered to Galanz. Galanz wrote back and said, "What a pity. We would have loved to have published your anthology of old age. But one has just been published this month. Two will never do." But she was writing continuously and all.
Was she?
Yes.
Did she have any career apart from being your wife, and writing? I mean, did she?
Well, she was quite a splendid teacher.
A school teacher?
Yes. She was trained in the early days. 2 years. I think it was Swansea Training College.
What actually made her a suffragette? You know, you must have discussed
that. Oh, it was natural. I mean, she was an independent spirit. That's what makes the suffragette. I mean, anybody who studies the laws of England in those days, it finds that women are classified as lunatics and criminals. And so
did she actually become a member of the Society of Friends with you?
Yes.
Eventually?
Yes. And remained so right through.
Did she?
The mind that I look on is simply that's the officialism.
Yes.
I never resigned from the Society of Friends. But I wasn't going to tolerate what was happening.
No, I don't blame you. So I